I'm Amanda Plum, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Today, my guest is my favorite ranger, Ranger Robbie Astrove, who is an environmental activist and educator, as well as an HIV activist and a ranger at Mount Arabia. Thanks for joining me, Robbie.
Hi, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
So when we met, you were an arborist for Trees Atlanta, and I feel like we got off to a rocky start because I'm sure I told you that I hate trees.
That's right.
Because as a new homeowner, there were acorns falling over my yard. I couldn't grow plants. I couldn't grow a garden because there was so much shade. And also, more recently, a tree fell on my house and damaged my house. So I'm not a huge tree fan. Can you convince me why trees are good? Why I should like them?
Yeah, I do remember that. And I knew that I would turn you around at some point.
Oh, you think you have? Did you not hear that a tree fell on my house?
Well, it's interesting. So while I was at Trees Atlanta, I had the most beautiful job in the world. Here I am trying to give away free trees. So I knock on doors, and I need to gain permission from a homeowner. You'd be surprised by how many people would say no.
I would not be surprised because trees are horrible.
Right. You got all these leaves to rake.
Oh, that was the other thing. I hate raking leaves. Right. Thanks for reminding me. Another reason I hate trees.
Pesky acorns.
Yeah.
Trees are falling left and right.
They really have been over the past couple of years. So yeah, why should we like trees? Why should I like trees, Robbie?
Well, it's funny because a lot of the people that have problems with it are some of the older folk. So
are you calling me old?
No, but let's say you have to know who your audience is and who you're talking to. So you know what I asked the older folks? I said, "Tell me about the neighborhood when you moved in here 30 years ago. There was more trees." This has to be. They tell me. And so we start talking about the value of the trees and how they provide shade. You can save money on electricity bills, having something pretty to look at. And what I get to is, well, let's talk about the legacy that you want to leave behind. You have an opportunity to receive a free tree planted by me and make a beautiful statement about the future and generations and generations and generations after you. And when you talk to people older in their life, they're definitely thinking about their legacy and how cool to leave a living legacy behind. Sometimes that's not going to get folks excited. Sometimes it's going to be, you know, a really pretty flower, something aesthetic. Sometimes straight up, we got to talk about money. And there's plenty of research that shows that trees on properties increase property value by 7 to 10%. It's a great investment. There's really something stately about a house with two oak trees planted on either side and under this beautiful canopy. Can you see that?
Maybe.
You know, think of these homes in Grant Park, this beautiful canopy. There's plenty of realtors I've spoken to that tell me that because of this tree, this house was bought by someone. When you see an awesome tree, it speaks to people. So there's lots of research and arguments and angles, but there's environmental benefits like clean air. There's social benefits like gathering and having a community that feels pride by planting trees. And there's economic benefits like shopping centers with trees actually get visited more than barren shopping centers.
We're going to spend a lot of time talking about your environmental activism, but let's get to know you first.
Sure.
So where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
I come from South Florida. I was born in Miami, 1978. And I stayed in South Florida for, you know, almost 20 years of my life. It's a place I love. It's a place that's very warm and sunny and tropical. And I'm very blessed to have been brought up there in a place where I could spend a lot of time outside, run around in shorts all year, go to the beach, be close to my family and friends.
And when did you develop an interest in environmental issues?
Yeah, you know, it's a question that comes up because this is very much reflects who I am, what I do, my career. And, you know, part of it does go back to, you know, running around in shorts 12 months of the year, just being outside, paying attention to what was around me. May have not known it at the time that I was going to develop a great interest in the environment. But I think just by the virtue of being there, the experience alone definitely contributed. And I definitely had some great mentors in my life.
Who was one of your mentors?
One of my earliest mentors was my mom's boyfriend and fiance, who was a native plant landscaper. And sometimes I would help him out on the weekends. And what ended up happening is we get a bunch of mulch dumped at our yard, and I'd have to spread it. And it kind of sucked at first. It was yard work. You know, all kids don't really aren't into yard work. But here I am 20 years later making my career spreading mulch. but he, you know, just allowed me to develop this appreciation for the outdoors, for plants, you know, for having a well-kept yard, native plants. He knew that I was interested, and he supported me.
Did you have a garden or plants when you were younger?
We didn't have a garden like the food growing garden, but our front yard systematically went from grass to a forest and a jungle, and we kind of were like the people on the block with the jungle front yard. But it took several years, and you know, I had a big role in it, planting stuff and mowing less and less yard, less grass.
I think some people might not understand why that's a good thing. So can you paint a picture for us to understand why a jungle is preferable to a lawn?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, there's an aesthetic. And some people, you know what, maybe they prefer to have a nice grass yard. But you know what? That takes a lot of time to maintain. You're mowing it. There's a dependency on petroleum and chemicals. And, you know, striving for the perfect yard, there's a better way. You know, why not have beautiful native plants that are self-maintaining, that have flowers, attract butterflies, less maintenance? That just seems is a more sustainable landscape. It might even be more inspiring landscape, certainly something more pretty to look at than cut grass. And then you have more free time to do things that you really want to do.
Oh, and what did you like to do in your free time as a kid?
I just really liked the drums. I could always remember having the radio on as a kid and my mom playing Beatles records and stuff. And I just always had this kind of innate sense of rhythm and music.
You went to middle school at a performing art middle school?
As a way to kind of support my interest, my folks found this magnet school in the complete other side of town, Norland Middle School, and they had a performing arts magnet program, art, music, dance, drama, and I had to apply. I had an audition.
And what did you audition with?
On the snare drum.
So you already played drums?
Just for maybe a year or two. And I thought, hey, this would be kind of neat. And magnet schools really were about desegregation, but they provide specialized coursework in music for me. And so I was in the band, and I also was in the concert band as well. And I started reading music, started playing music, had a music history class. It was definitely more formalized. Almost 20 years later, I'm still playing drums.
Who do you play with now?
So now I'm with a group in Atlanta. It's the Dielect Trio, and we're a transnational fusion group. And that means that we're playing a blend of music from all around the world, from different continents, from North America to Africa to South America. It's all original music. We play a lot of cumbia. There's some reggae, some funk, different Afrobeat. It's really fun. I really stand behind the music. It feels good to me.
As we go into our break, why don't you play one of your songs?
Yeah, I brought a track from one of our more recent LPs. It's a cumbia, and I mentioned that earlier, and cumbia is the national music of Colombia. And what was happening in the 70s and the 60s, American music was having a great influence all over the world. So this very traditional South American music kind of got funkified, and it got James Brownified, and you could hear electric instruments. And so this very particular style of cumbia, chicha, started being played in the 60s and 70s. It was slightly more psychedelic and a little out there. And so we've tried to capture that chicha sound, and you get to hear a little bit right now. So this is an original composed by Russ Bledsoe, our guitarist, and it's a favorite of mine.
What's it called?
It's Cumbia de Rus.
Cumbia de Rus?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
It's the cumbia. It's Russ's cumbia.
Oh, cool. All right, let's listen.
Thank you.
For a little bit of everything from all over the globe, tune into Weekend Cornucopia every Saturday and Sunday here on WREK Atlanta.
Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Amanda Plum, and today I'm talking with Ranger Robbie Astrove, who's an environmental activist and experiential educator. You went to an environmental high school?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I attended this school called Mass Academy. It's a public school in Day County, and it was a magnet school for marine science and technology.
Why did you decide to go to this high school? Were you already interested in the environment?
Well, to be honest, my home school, meaning, you know, the school I was a district to go to, was actually a pretty bad and rough school, and chances are I would have got my butt kicked every day had I gone there. And so these magnet schools were kind of a new concept in the early 90s, and they had different specializations. This Mass Academy seemed like a really good opportunity, and I definitely had an interest in just science. You know, we had this science museum in Miami that I always liked going to as a kid, and had a little lab set at some point. So, you know, you put all the pieces together and, you know, like, you know, he's a science-y kind of kid. So that was definitely part of it. But honest to God, this was going to provide me with a really good education and perhaps give me a little more specialization in math, science, technology, which is, you know, kind of neat for a kid. And so I had an opportunity to take some really exciting classes in high school, including college-level ecology classes that I got dual enrollment for. So I took high school classes, got college credit for it, learned about the Everglades, went on a lot of field trips. And what happened to me in high school is I got this really great sense of the flavor of what is experiential education. We don't have to be stuck in a classroom all the time. We can actually go out into the world, see it, experience it, and learn it that way, which turns out to be a more powerful way of learning. And so that high school experience prepared me for college very well. It was very rigorous. But it really pointed me into a specific direction to learn more about the world around me, the study of ecology, plants, and really how humans are interacting with the planet. And that was the beginning of my passion and my career and just who I am today.
Are there any field trips that stand out for you?
Yeah. We went down to the Keys, which is 3 or 4 hours away, and we went snorkeling on Lou Key, which is still today known as one of the best protected coral reefs in, you know, the United States. And, you know, just me and my classmates, and we're snorkeling and we're seeing fish go by, and it was just one of those magical days of being in the water and the salt air and the sun and just, you know, being in school, quotes, and going on a snorkel field trip. It was great.
What did that mean to you?
It meant a lot of things, you know. It was this beautiful combination of adventure, of learning, and, you know, having a shared experience with someone, you know, my classmates. You know, we were all just, you know, geeky high school kids, but I remember, like, who was in my boat, and, you know, that's the power of maybe the outdoors and, you know, having these shared experiences in nature with people.
Did you actually learn anything?
Yeah, we learned all about, you know, what was killing the coral reefs and marine ecology and the food web, and, you know, and now that I'm an educator, I'm a teacher, I try to infuse the same spirit of fun and adventure. And so today I was teaching these group of kids, and when it was all said and done, I looked over at my volunteer. I said, you know what? Those kids didn't even realize how much they learned today. They were just kicking back in the sunshine, planting trees, having a good time, but yet there was something powerful. There was a takeaway message that I left them with. I left them with a call to action. They learned practical skills on planting a tree. Maybe they got to know themselves better. Maybe they had a moment of contemplation out there alone in the woods.
What was your favorite class?
My favorite class, you know, I took an oceanography class in high school, and it was something I didn't really give a lot of thought to. But when you learn how the oceans are pretty much connected to the whole world and, like, our climate and wind patterns and temperatures and migration, it's really something to think about.
Did you have a favorite teacher?
I did. I really was fond of my English teacher, Miss Devonshire, and also our art instructor, Craig Kirk, who, yeah, he taught art, but I think he taught life more.
What do you mean?
He was just a really great kind of mentor. Students felt really comfortable with him. And, you know, I think through art, we were able to discuss what was happening in our lives and current events and, you know, what does art mean? And, you know, being young and having a voice and having a message. And he was able to kind of capture that and encourage us to be creative in our lives, even if we were like really crappy artists like I was. But it was this idea of art that he taught in a way to live your life as a free spirit and someone with freedom. And I think I carry that forward in what I do now.
So when you were in high school, you got some kind of life-changing news. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I did. In 1995, I was 15 years old, I found out that I was HIV positive. And it was a life-changing moment.
How did you find out?
You know, we talked about me being a musician. I'm a drummer. And I got a really bad infection on my finger, a staph infection. It was from a blister. And I went to my doctor, and she took one look at it. She said, you're going to have surgery tomorrow morning. It was like borderline like gangrene. This really weird, intense, serious infection. And when something like that happens, you need to ask some questions on why that's happening. And so I had some basic blood work done, and everything came back fine, except one thing was a little questionable, which led to more questions being asked. And long story short, they said, Robbie, we'd like to give you an HIV test so we can rule it out, so we can say it's not that, something else.
What did you think of when they said they were going to give you an HIV test?
I never even crossed my head, but I said, you know what? You know, sometimes we know things by knowing what it's not. So, yeah, let's go ahead and do it, rule it out, cross it off the list, and get to the bottom of it, all right? We did get to the bottom of it, and the HIV test came back positive. And I remember going back to get the test results, and they actually called my parents in first, so I thought it was a little weird. And I got there, about 5 minutes passed, and starting to think, wow, it's pretty long. Got called into the room, and my parents were sitting down kind of in tears. And they told me what the results were. And there was silence, but I put my head up and I looked at them. The first thing I said was, okay, what are we going to do now? And I just I've always kept that spirit of action, and, you know, it was never a death sentence for me. I don't know how I knew early on that I was going to beat this thing or be healthy, but here I was at 15 with some earth-shattering news, but I decided to take the high road at that moment and to stay positive.
Were you ever worried that you would not live a long time?
You know, fortunately for me and the timing, we were kind of right at the cusp of it not so much being a death sentence and kind of coming into a new paradigm of a manageable disease. But that takes 10 years. It's medically taking that long, but it's also just in our everyday attitude of the disease, and there's stigma and other things, and that's changed too.
Did they have any idea of how you might have contracted it?
Not really. I mean, we had this pretty healthy 15-year-old, but when I was born in 1978, I had 3 life-saving blood transfusions. I was born with a severe case of beta strep pneumonia. I was dying. I had emergency transfer to another hospital, and they gave me blood and saved my life. Fast forward 15 years.
Did learning that you're HIV positive change things for you as a high school student?
Yeah. You know, just getting beyond the earth-shattering part, I actually took an interest in the disease right away. I was starting to read like scientific journals, and I don't know, I just really felt like motivated and empowered to be in charge of my life and my medical decisions. And someone told me that I was going to be on this amazing journey and road of self-educating myself. And so I started reading these journals and learning about how the disease is changing. But again, in public education, they're not really always current on stuff. So we happen to be in class and we're talking about HIV and AIDS. And, you know, my heart kind of dropped. And I'm listening to the teacher describe, you know, just the basic progression of things. And you are HIV positive. And then in 10 years later, you develop AIDS and you die. And so I kind of had a chuckle to myself thinking, no, you're born and you get a life-saving blood transfusion and you're 15 years old and you're healthy and doing fine. And that was my attitude. And so they were wrong.
And as an adult, you've kind of become an HIV activist. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I do consider myself an activist. I think I'm more of an educator, you know, both in the sense of the environmental work that I do and perhaps even the HIV. I'm not afraid to advocate, though, when there's something that's wrong that needs to be fixed. You know, very early in the disease, I wasn't telling anyone. Again, I was 15 years old. We all know how cruel high school people are. So I kept it in. And honestly, it was something that people just didn't need to know. I was still the same old Robbie and doing everything that I was doing. I was very fortunate. But as time grew and I did slowly open up and tell people, I realized I had tremendous power in the story to talk to someone and to be that face, to be that person in their life that HIV affects, because so many people don't have that personal connection. And until you have it, that's when the disease means something to you. And if I could be that conduit, that connection to someone, maybe they would have more protected sex. Maybe they would hear someone telling a friend telling a joke about AIDS and say, no, that's not right. I wanted to do that. So I started to share my story and became a couple friends. And it really escalated in the last couple of years where, you know, I became a spokesperson for the AIDS Walk here in Atlanta with my wife, Danielle, both of us together, to be the face and to provide more connection. So I got on a stage, spoke to 10,000 people, been on TV, front page of AJC, the works.
So what kind of reaction did you get the day after you were on the front page of the AJC?
I was terrified, but it's been nothing but amazing, positive stories after one after another. Emails, letters, people from other states writing to Danielle and I, telling us how courageous we are and how they're in the same situation.
Why did they see you guys as courageous?
Just being heartfelt and honest and just really putting it out there, you know, what our lives are like. And really, and this is what Danielle really brings to the table, is it's completely possible to be married and to have a normal life and maybe even have kids as someone who's HIV positive. And what Danielle has brought and coming out with me is, like, it's not just me that people need to be concerned about. It's people like her, the caregivers, the caretakers. It's a pretty big burden for her too. You know, the question of, have you ever thought about myself dying? Well, what about her and her life partner leaving the planet slightly earlier? You know, it affects a lot of people. And friends and family. That's the conversation, that's the dialogue that we wanted to have as being spokespeople.
Does being HIV positive relate in any way to the work you've done as an environmental educator?
I think so. Whether I know it or not, I think it drives me. Not that I, you know, think that, you know, my time on the planet's going to be shorter than anyone else, but I certainly want to do a lot. I want to live a productive life. Would have I had the same passion if I didn't find out about this crazy disease in me? I'm not sure, but I think most of all, the connection has been my perspective on the disease. And so when I talk to groups and people, I sometimes talk about how elegant HIV is. And
people, elegant?
Yeah. And people, what are you talking about, Robbie? I say, well, yes, this disease is completely having a war inside my body, but you know what? As a biologist, it's really able to reproduce millions of times every day. It's biologically superior to the other things. Its DNA has all these really cool attributes, yet it's kind of killing me. But within that, I develop a respect for it, and I can honor HIV. And because I have this honor and respect, I think I'm more at peace. and being out in nature all the time, breathing fresh air, having an appreciation of the wildness in the world, makes me honor and appreciate the wildness inside of me.
This is the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Amanda Plum, and today I'm talking with Ranger Robbie Astrove, who's an environmental activist and experiential educator. So what did you do after high school?
So after high school, I got accepted to Florida State University in Tallahassee, about 10 hours to the north. I was really excited about, you know, living in a new place. And I didn't really have any major plans for college. So I was taking a very general approach to education until I got this letter from the dean, probably in my junior year, saying it's time to declare a major. And he gave me a big course booklet, and I went through it, and I couldn't choose. It all sounded so great. That's the beautiful thing about college, is go out and just learn about the world. But when I took all the pages that I flagged that I just had interest in, it turned out to be in the School of Geography. And I got a degree in environmental studies, and I also got a degree in interdisciplinary social science, which essentially was a big grab bag of classes from many different departments. I got to handpick my education.
Was there an aha moment for you when you realized that you wanted to do environmental work for the rest of your life?
Well, just to trace back my career very briefly, but, you know, when I graduated college, or even just my college coursework, was very much in this camp of conservation ecology, and already I knew that not only did I just want to study this stuff, but there was an end result of saving it and protecting it. And I think it's important to mention, because we all are learning a skill, or we have skills and we have talents, but sometimes we have to think deeply about what are we putting it to and how are we applying it. So I knew from very early on that I want to be involved in the conservation movement.
Why?
It was the right thing to do. I was already pretty evident that things were not going to be good for mankind. Species extinctions, global warming, carbon. I felt really inspired to be a part of the solution, to do the right thing, to take care of the planet, to be a planetary steward while I'm here. This is my job, my obligation. The planet takes care of me, I'm going to take care of the planet. And so early on, my first couple jobs were more in the scientific realm, I guess, and doing data collection and studying plants and working at a university. Or I was a surveyor for a long time, doing mapping projects that went into knowing where certain things were so they could be conserved. But then there was an aha moment, and it was going to all these conferences and seeing all these brilliant scientists. But where was it having influence? Was it causing true behavior change? Were people reading this stuff and saying, okay, I understand about the problem. You know what? I'm going to start shopping differently. I'm going to put more attention on, you know, the types of companies I support. I'm going to recycle more. What was happening is there wasn't any translator, so to speak, between the scientific community and the Joe public. I said, you know what? That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to teach. And it wasn't just being a teacher in a classroom, but I wanted to be an experiential educator. I wanted to take people out into the forest, out into a wetlands, and have them see something maybe they'd never seen before. And whether it's wildlife or a special plant, and just be there and walk away from that experience and be moved. And eventually they'll have that same passion and fire to conserve and to protect. But it starts with the experience. People don't know what they have. They don't know what they're going to lose.
You're not just teaching about trees. You're planting a lot of trees around the city.
Yeah. Something happened a couple years ago when I was asked to do a presentation for a conference. And I thought, why should I do a PowerPoint? Why don't I just do it for real? And again, this is back to this model of experiential education. So whenever I do teaching on a number of topics, we're learning by doing. So if I have to teach someone how to plant a tree, we're going to plant a tree. And so as a result, all these things end up happening in the name of education.
Can you describe kind of a successful experience that you created?
My first orchard I ever did was at the Burgess Peterson Academy, 2009. School's in East Atlanta. And I attended this meeting about the school wanting to have a garden. It was like the first one. And it was all these neighbors and one of the school teachers. And the result was starting a garden. And I saw an opportunity to put fruit trees in to add value to the school. And when it was planting day, it was a really beautiful thing. We had teachers there. We had students there. We had parents, the PTA president. And so when you get the community and you get the school involved in the planting, they directly become connected to it. They become stakeholders. And whenever I'm doing a planting like I did today, I tell and remind everyone, come back, come and see your trees and feel good that this was planted by you. So I just try to help build that connection.
Earlier today, you were doing a pruning class at Truly Living Well at Wheat Street Gardens. Tell me about that class.
Truly Living Well is an urban agriculture nonprofit group, and they're farmers. They're growing food. They're training young farmers to be stewards, and they're helping the city be healthier. And so they have this wonderful site, Wheat Street Gardens. It's right in downtown in the old Fourth Ward. There's over 70 raised beds where they're growing vegetables 12 months out of the year. And what makes the site very unique, perhaps more so than any other garden in the city, is over 100 fruit trees. And so Rashid, like me, shares this vision of sustainable agriculture, integrating fruit trees into the landscape, and there will be food on the trees for decades. It's very exciting.
So let's hear a little of you in action in the pruning class.
What we want to do is, all these cuts have been intentional to put energy out, but we're leaving this like it is so the tree knows to keep on going up. The moment that we cut anywhere on here, that energy is going to stop going up, and now we're going to start splitting it. And so that's something good to think about because, you know, where are we going to be 5 years from now? So we have to start making those decisions now. And being that it's so close to the kids' area, and we made some intentional choices to keep these low branches for easy picking, maybe we actually do want to come and top this. And that's telling the tree, you're going to be stunted. You're going to have, you know, you're going to have a short, yeah, short and sweet. So that's what pruning is about, is, you know, creating shape, architecture. And then if you have, like, you know, a special purpose in mind to serve an audience, kids, you know, let's hook it up for them.
Is that a pretty typical training that you do?
Pretty much. You know, what I want to do for people is to give them confidence so they can do it on their own or maybe even teach someone else. So it's all experiential. Today we're doing a pruning class. And so I'll kind of start to prune and let people observe me. But really slowly what I'm doing is pushing other people into more leadership roles, asking them questions, building their confidence up, and allowing them to do the work. There's only so much that could be learned by reading a book or even watching me. It's really forcing them to do the work and let the tree and themselves teach more than ever I could.
What do you mean the tree teaches?
Well, with pruning, it's a very methodical, scientific, and aesthetic approach to creating a tree. So the tree teaches us by every cut we make, there's cause and effect. So we're going to go back next year and evaluate if we got the result that we were looking for. And so by returning to the tree and by planning in consecutive years, because what we did today wasn't just for next year, it was actually for the next 5 years. So there's a lot of history that goes into pruning, and there's a lot of forward thinking that goes into pruning as well.
Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. Today, my guest is my favorite ranger, Ranger Robbie Astrove.
I'm just really blessed to work every day in a beautiful, inspiring place. It's the Davis and Arabia Mountain Nature Preserve. It's in Lithonia. It's only 20 minutes from Atlanta. And, you know, we all know Atlanta is a big city, but there's this world just 20 minutes away that takes you back into time. And there's a huge granite outcrop, a mountain. Everyone knows Stone Mountain, but Stone Mountain has an older sister. It's Arabia, 100 million years older. And so part of my job as a park ranger is to, and it's kind of poetic, but, you know, lead people up the mountain. And a lot of people are interested to hear facts and figures, and I tell them stuff, but you know what, Amanda? When I get to the top, I shut up. And I let the mountain teach. And people open up. And sometimes they talk about God. Sometimes they talk about they've never been to a place like that. Sometimes they just say, wow, how beautiful is this? And I follow up with, if I blindfolded you, would you believe that you were 20 minutes from downtown? And they can't believe it.
I remember the first time I ever went to Mount Arabia, my friend Warren took me years and years ago. I had no idea it existed. And Stone Mountain, even though they look kind of similar in one respect, but Stone Mountain's got so many people and it's got popcorn and a cable car and all these things. But Mount Arabia, yeah, it does look like you're nowhere near the city. It feels like you're in a completely different part of the country.
It's very raw. It's nature and it's this purest essence. And so there's not a lot of people. There's no theme park. You're typically there alone. You have a beautiful 360-degree view. It's inspiring. You're on top of a mountain.
What are your favorite places in Mount Arabia?
Oh, man, there's a bunch. Well, of course, I love the top of the mountain. But there's some also really neat, like, wetlands there, too. Creeks, riparian areas. You know, I'm really into this thing. It's hard to describe, but it's kind of where two vegetation communities meet, you know. In Atlanta, we have different neighborhoods. We live in East Atlanta, and one neighborhood away is Edgewood. And, you know, you ask people, you know, go to, you know, in between the neighborhoods, and it's a little bit of East Atlanta, it's a little edgy, and a little bit of Edgewood. So the same thing happens in nature. You have these vegetation communities. So I like to find the places where two vegetation communities are starting to blend to each other. And there's a name for that. It's an ecotone, and it's places that have more biological diversity. Typically, you have more medicinal plants. Essentially, what you have is species found in one place surviving with species found in another place. So there's that overlap effect. And historically, it's where people have chosen to live because there's an abundance of things found in a place where you'd have to travel the two.
What are the ecosystems that are colliding at Mount Arabia?
So it's just when a dry mountain ridge meets a wetter, more shadier creek. And so there's somewhere they're going to kind of blend together. And once you know what you're looking for, it's obvious. And so there's a couple little, there's Laurel Creek, which is a trail at the nature preserve. And it has a little secret waterfall. And there's ferns everywhere. It's a beautiful little creek valley. It's just real special.
What about Fairyland?
Yeah, we have lots of little local names that were given by hikers. And so Fairyland is this kind of remote outcrop, and it's an exposed area. And the reason it was given the name Fairyland is it really has this magical quality to it. There's all these lichens. And if you go to Fairyland, especially after rain, oh my God, it's super cool. There's like mosses everywhere and they're all glowing green. There's all these cedar trees. You can tell the air is much cleaner there. You could physically feel and taste the air. It's fresh. So it's just this magical place. And you know, there's places like that all over.
Last time I visited Mount Arabia, you gave me a tour of some of your favorite places. Is that something that's open to the public?
Yeah, the park is owned by the public, and we're open sunrise to sunset, 365 days a year. The trails are open all the time. There is a small nature center. We do have kind of regular business hours, but yeah, everyone's welcome to come and hike. I lead guided hikes every Friday morning and Sunday morning at 8 a.m. And we meet at the nature center, and we try and go somewhere different almost every time.
Whether it's rock, blues, electronic, hip-hop, R&B, or reggae, they all have one thing in common.
You can hear them all during the Rock, Rhythm, and Wolves Sound Block, Monday through Thursday from 1 to 6 p.m. and 1 to 5 p.m. on Fridays, only at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Amanda Plum, and today I'm talking with Ranger Robbie Astrove, who's an environmental activist and experiential educator. So, Robbie, I hear there's a revolution going on. Tell me about the fruit tree revolution.
Yeah, this is something I'm really excited about. What's been really neat about having a career in the environment is my ability to kind of do different things. So early on, I was a wetland scientist, and then when I was living out west, I was doing more wilderness work. And so when I came into Atlanta, Atlanta's a city and a forest, working at Trees Atlanta was a great job for me, which I did for 4 years. And I was became an arborist and celebrated native trees. A couple of years ago, I started taking a lot notice to the exciting urban agriculture movement here in Atlanta, the local food movement, farmers, farm to table restaurants. And I was thinking, how am I going to get involved in this? And I had to basically rectify something very serious and opposing is, as a tree guy, an arborist, I'm a shade maker. I'm planting all these big trees. And all these gardeners, they're sun seekers. They want sun to grow their veggies. And I knew I wasn't going to be a veggie grower. And I thought and thought and thought. And it hit me one day that fruit trees were the answer. That I could continue to be an arborist and plant trees, which I love and so passionate about, but also contribute to the local food movement. And then all of a sudden I started planting less oaks and planting more pawpaws and other fruit trees. And now it's like my passion. Some people call me Robbie Appleseed, and I'm just planting all the time. What I've been doing is helping farms, community gardens, and even residents plant fruit trees all over the city.
Robbie, there's a group you've been working with for a while now called the Concrete Jungle. Tell us about Concrete Jungle.
Yeah, Concrete Jungle is one of my favorite volunteer projects that I'm currently engaged in. And what Concrete Jungle does is locate and map out all this public produce. Public produce is fruit trees and berry bushes that's just growing out in the city. Most of it's in public property, parks, and things like that. And then what we do is we go out and we harvest it. We collect all this unused fruit that typically falls to the ground, goes to waste, and then we donate it to homeless shelters and food banks, people that really need it.
How did that get started?
Concrete Jungle has two founders, Craig and Aubrey, and they started several years ago, probably like 5 or 6 years ago, and it started because they noticed all these apples everywhere on the ground. They thought to themselves, we could do something with these apples. And they donated a bunch, and eventually every fall, so when the apples come, they come, there's a lot of them, they held an annual cider fest, and they juiced all these apples and turned them to cider, had a whole bunch of trampolines and kids and dogs, just had a big free cider fest. And that grew into more of an organization that went and searched out not just for apples, but for everything else. And because of our climate here in Atlanta, we have an amazing abundance of different fruits that live here, such as fig, plums, peaches, pomegranates, American and Japanese persimmon, there's pears, service berries.
So how does it happen? How do you guys go get the fruit?
So we have organized picks every Sunday with volunteers, and we utilize all sorts of different social media and email lists that we collect, and we say, meet us here at this time. And when you get there, you'll meet Concrete Jungle, and you'll see people with tarps and ladders. And what we do is we basically go around shaking trees and catching fruit in little tarp parachutes. And it's really fun, and you can eat as much fruit as you want while you're with us. But almost exclusively, it all gets donated to homeless shelters and food banks.
Is it legal to go out and pick these fruit in public places?
I mean, honestly, I don't think there's any rules saying that you can't. Obviously, if there's trees on private property, we're not advocating people go and pick other people's trees. That's called stealing. But in a public setting, where the food is just going to fall and go to waste, we feel that there's a higher purpose for the food. So we're going to go in and do something. It's a form of activism.
So just between you and me, tell me like one tree in the city, like where I can find one fruit, one rogue fruit tree where I can go get a little snack.
Yeah, there's one tree that came to mind. I just saw it this week. It's in Washington Park neighborhood, which is on the west side. It's one of Atlanta's first African-American neighborhoods. And right next to the natatorium, the pool there, there is this really great American persimmon. And the reason I want to draw attention to this tree is found in the forest all over the city. This tends to be a very big one. There's lots of fruit. And people tend not to like persimmon, or they think they don't like it. You're giving me a funny look, Amanda.
I'm giving you a funny look because you and Danielle had me over for dinner not too long ago. And you were all excited and you went out to your car and came back with what looked like the nastiest, most rotten, disgusting pieces of fruit ever. And you said they were persimmons. And I've had persimmons before, and they are normally orange and firm and look very different than these things you were trying to claim were edible. So what I didn't realize is the persimmons I'm used to from the grocery store are Japanese persimmons, and that American persimmons look totally different. And even though they look like the rotting fruit, it was like, they're like, it was amazing. It was like one of the most amazing things I'd ever had. And we all thought you were crazy. Like, we all looked at you like, I remember Danielle's like, Robbie, don't serve them that. Don't bring that in the house. Like, how long has that been in your car? And so I can imagine this tree where it looks like there's rotting fruit. I guess no one would ever guess that that's like amazing snack right there.
They are. They're so delicious. It's like candy. And so the Asian persimmons are a non-astringent fruit that you could eat fresh right off the tree. But the American persimmon is different. And there's probably a lot of people listening and they can recall trying a persimmon and then having the worst taste in their mouth ever. And it's like your mouth turns to this chalk and it's totally just like puckers up. So the trick with American persimmon is you have to wait for it to basically fall. And it's like this deep red, purple. And yeah, sometimes it looks a little nasty, but they're so sweet. And so part of my work with Concrete Jungle is to like bring awareness to these fruits that people just don't really know about. Remember, this is native to North America. They're found growing in any forest patch in Atlanta. So there's persimmon close to everyone. We just haven't tried it yet. We don't know about it.
And what time of year should we go looking for persimmons on the ground?
So persimmons are ready in the fall time. Usually it's between when the leaves fall and the first freeze. They actually get sweeter if they go through, you know, that first frost.
And is there an educational component to the Concrete Jungle?
Absolutely. People just have this interest to know what is it that they're doing and what are they looking at and what are they tasting. So we're always answering questions for people, but we also have a very educational website. Part of the mission of Concrete Jungle is just to let people be aware that, yes, there's all this fruit growing crazy in the city. And so we have an identification page. We keep a lot of data on when harvests are happening. We have very, very good records. We know exactly when the peak week is for every fruit, which helps us then go back and plan all this picking. We have over 1,000 trees that we monitor in the city. It's a lot of work.
And I hear you guys have a farm now. How did that happen?
Yeah, we have Doghead Farm, and it was donated property to us. It's in the Sullivan Hills neighborhood. And like many open vacant lots, it was full of weeds, kudzu, lots of undesirables. And we've been working steadily to transform the site into a farm. And now we're growing food on it 12 months out of the year. It has an orchard. We have different rows of vegetables, herb garden, vines and trellises and berry bushes. It's really diverse, and all that food gets donated too.
Cool. What are the plans for 2013 for Concrete Jungle?
Yeah, we have lots of big plans. Our bread and butter isn't going to change, which is going around the city and picking fruit, but it is very logistically stressful. We're driving everywhere. And so what we want to do now is put more focus on planting fruit trees where they're actually needed the most, in places like food deserts, for example, where there's no accessibility to fresh and healthy food. And so instead of delivering food, we're just going to plant the food where it needs to go. So we have all sorts of orchard plans for 2013 and parks and other public spaces, and then also private property people that have allowed us to come in and do that.
So are there people that are against planting fruit trees?
Well, the fruit trees are fighting a stigma that they're very messy, that the fruit drops on the ground and attracts rats. That requires all sorts of specialized maintenance, usually maintenance needs that go beyond the education of city park employees. There's some truth to that, but I think what Concrete Jungle is basically demonstrating is that not so. We have all these neglected trees around the city that are feeding the city, that are very high producing. I mean, we had one tree in Dunwoody give us 500 pounds of pears.
What?
And no one even knows about it. No one cares about this tree. It's just, it's kind of overgrown. Could it use a little love? Sure. But here's the example of no one giving any love to this tree and it's doing just fine. So that's the proof that I share with different government officials that are not so sold on it. And I think they could really flip the switch on why we're doing it. And if we're concerned about obesity and healthy living and trying to attract people to the park, well, let's give them something to actually go there for. You know, start an apple grove in a city park, have public picks, you know, bring a chef to the community rec center to do a demo on, you know, 4th of July apple pie making. That would be really exciting, and they wouldn't have to go far for it. So these trees are really going to be valuable once we start to link in nutrition, healthy lifestyle, cooking. And the best thing of all, these fruit trees they're a part of our history and our culture. And so there's recipes to be shared. There's grandma's stories to be heard. You know, we can go there with fruit trees much easier than just talking about a native oak tree.
Wow. Well, this has been so educational. I've learned a lot, and I might even start liking trees. But I have one final question for you. And this is a question I ask all my guests, and it was submitted by my brother-in-law, Kevin Hernandez. He feels like there's two types of people in this world, whack-a-mole people and skee-ball people. Which are you and why?
Oh, I love skee-ball. I hit the 50s. You have this like bump and you have to make a judgment call and you have to actually do something and observe yourself and make adjustments. Whereas when you're whacking it, you're just like trying to be fast and you're trying to hit it and there's really no thought to it. But there's maybe a little more strategy with the skee ball, or maybe you actually bank it off and you can kind of try different things and eventually you find the sweet spot. And when you find that sweet spot and you're hitting those 50s one after another, it's such a great feeling. And that's why I think I'm a skee ball person.
All right. So you're involved in a lot of stuff. If people want to learn more about Dialect Trio, where is that available?
Yeah, we have our complete discography online. It's dialecttrio.com.
Where can we get more information about Mount Arabia?
We have a wonderful website that features all sorts of program information, maps, hiking schedules. And so I work the weekends and I lead a hike every Friday and Sunday at 8 in the morning, leaving from the Nature Center.
Cool. And I'm guessing that Concrete Jungle is always looking for people to get involved and help pick fruit. Do they have a website?
Absolutely. We also have a website and we're very much in need of volunteers.
Well, thank you so much for coming today, Robbie. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks for having me, Amanda. This is great.
Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. If you want to listen to this or other episodes, you can visit our website, wrak.org/North Ave. And we'll see you again next week.